You're listening to CNAS Live, our on-the-go audio version of recent events hosted by the Center for New American Security. International terrorism and domestic violent extremism are once again at the forefront of U.S. national security concerns. As a result of the October 7th Hamas attack on Israel, anti-Semitism has been increasing at an exponential rate both in the U.S. and around the world. On Friday, December 1st, CNAS hosted a virtual event with Michael Masters, National Director and CEO of the Secure Community Network. Carrie Cordero, Robert M. Gates Senior Fellow at CNAS, moderated the conversation. They discussed anti-Semitism in the U.S., the work of the Secure Community Network, and the way forward to combat anti-Semitism and the accompanying outbreak in violence and aggression. This conversation is a part of our Safe at Home speaker series that focuses on challenges to homeland security. Topics include international and domestic terrorism, political violence, mass shootings and gun violence, pandemic preparedness and response, climate-related emergency management, and cybersecurity. You can learn more about the Safe at Home series and subscribe to the newsletter at cnas.org/safe-home. Here's their conversation.
Good afternoon on the East Coast, good morning on the West Coast, and welcome to the relaunch of our speaker series, Safe at Home, at the Center for a New American Security. I'm Carrie Cordero. The Safe at Home series is a component of our Securing U.S. Democracy initiative here at the Center. The series is intended to bring greater attention to safety and security issues that affect Americans on a daily basis in their communities. As democracy is under strain in many parts of the world, it's important that we regularly and persistently highlight how democracy delivers for people in their daily lives. One of the things that it must deliver is a reasonable degree of safety and security. So in this series, we're going to talk about homeland security issues and challenges such as international and domestic terrorism, political violence against government officials, challenges for law enforcement, and mass shootings. We will be featuring leaders at the state, local, and community level, including those who work outside of government, who are solving problems and leading on the ground efforts to keep Americans safer. Today, we are talking about the rise of anti-Semitism in the United States and the accompanying security and safety challenges that it presents. I am joined by a leader on this issue, Michael Masters, who is the National Director and CEO of the Secure Community Network. Michael, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Great. And I want to share with our viewers just a little bit about Michael's background. In his role as the CEO for the Secure Community Network, he is responsible for the overall leadership, operation, and growth of the official safety and security organization for the Jewish community throughout North America. He is also my colleague on the Homeland Security Advisory Council, and he also serves on the Faith-Based Security Advisory Council, as well as a number of other task forces and working groups. Prior to joining Secure Community Networks, he was Senior Vice President at the Soufan Group and also previously served at state and local government as the Executive Director of the Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management for Cook County, as well as for the Chicago Police Department and with the mayor of Chicago. Michael is also a commissioned officer in the United States Marine Corps, where he attained the rank of captain. So again, Michael, thanks so much for being with us for this relaunch of the Safe at Home series that we are kicking back off this year. I just want to share with our viewers a couple notes about the virtual conversation today. This conversation is live and being live streamed on CNAS's website and all of our social media channels. And the video recording of this session will be available on the CNAS website, and the audio will be available on our CNAS podcast channel, which is called CNAS Live, where you can find recordings of this and other CNAS events with top national and homeland security leaders. So, Michael, we are currently, the Jewish community and Americans generally, in a heightened threat environment FBI Director Chris Wray testified before Congress earlier this fall that although the Jewish community accounts for just over 2% of the U.S. population, it is currently accounts for approximately 60% of being targeted in religious-based hate crimes in the United States. So that is the current environment. But before we get to that, I want to back up a little bit and ask you just about the Secure Community Network generally, because even though we're in this environment today, Secure Community Network and the work that you and your colleagues have been doing has been around for a couple decades. So can you give us sort of the sense of the origin of it and why it was created to begin with?
Certainly, Carrie, and thank you for the question. The threat environment we're facing today is a continuation for us as a Jewish community, unfortunately, of roughly 3,500 years of hate and anti-Semitism. SCN is an organization, we're a nonprofit organization, we are coming up on our 20th year anniversary. We were created in the aftermath, really, of September 11th, 2001, very similarly to the Department of Homeland Security. There was a recognition by federal law enforcement and community leadership in the Jewish community of a new threat paradigm. We saw directed threats towards the Jewish community domestically, particularly from organizations and individuals affiliated with or influenced by Al-Qaeda ideology, bin Ladenism. And so there was a real push to have an organization that was staffed by security professionals, former law enforcement, national security experts, that could serve as a liaison between federal law enforcement and what they were seeing and the Jewish community, and be able to communicate the threats that our federal partners were receiving, act in that liaison role, and then work with the community to essentially protect, prevent against, mitigate the effects of those attacks. And over the last 20 years, SCN has developed that capacity in a number of different areas to work to protect the community in what we now see as the most dynamic and complex threat environment, not only to ever face the Jewish community, but to ever face the United States of America.
So help us understand, you know, the CNAS audience is primarily folks who work and work adjacent to the national security, homeland security, and even law enforcement communities. So help us understand a little bit more how, as a nonprofit, staffed by many former security professionals who served in government, both at state and federal and local levels, how do you interact with the law enforcement and the security organizations and entities? I know there's an information sharing piece. There's obvious, and that probably goes both ways. There's an operational piece, but how do you interact with them in a way that doesn't step on toes, frankly, and doesn't interrupt what the government agencies are doing?
It's a great question. So maybe I'll take a step and explain how we're actually structured. So for those in the audience, we are very much similarly structured to a law enforcement agency in many ways. And in fact, when I took over this week, 6 years ago, we did a structural redesign to really reform the organization, almost like the FBI. We have a central headquarters, which is based in Chicago, which is where I met. We have a command center across the hall that functions as a fusion center, staffed by a professional team of analysts that are working 24/7. I'll come back to that. We divide the country into 10 regions. We have a regional director, so they are overlapping with the Department of Homeland Security's 10 regions. And then we have security directors who are all former law enforcement that are deployed in communities, often in partnerships with what we refer to in the Jewish communities, our Jewish Federation system. So many communities around the United States, 146 of them, have what are known as Jewish federations. Those are often the central convener and coordinator of Jewish life. Many of them have been around for decades, some over a century. They were created so the Jewish community had one place where they could pool their resources and then donate money to different agencies, work to convene with one another. So we have essentially security directors that function as special agents in charge of field offices around the country. And our central headquarters, which is developing coordinated training, assessment tools to do facility assessments, et cetera. And then that command center, which I mentioned. We work adjacent to and in complement to federal, state, and local law enforcement. So very simply, to use a basic example, across the hall, those analysts are scouring surface deep and dark web, all through open source tools. We are monitoring persons of interest, and we have a direct data feed to the FBI's National Threat Operations Center. So at any one point, at roughly once a day to two times a day, we are pushing to the NTOC a threat to life of some kind that our team identifies. So what we like to think of as those of us who've been in law enforcement know, there are many guidelines related to social media work, et cetera. Mm-hmm. What we like to be able to do is we like to work in our space, which is civil sector, nonprofit, identify bad actors, and then be able to take that and push those tips, as any citizen can, to law enforcement, who then can actualize it. So we try to take what is a real sea or sewer of information on the particularly online space and identify actual verified threats and then push those to our law enforcement partners to work on.
Let's drill down a little bit on that social media aspect, because I think one of the questions that we have is why is this happening now? And there's a pre and post October 7th aspect to this. The rise in anti-Semitism, both in the United States and around the world, predates the Hamas attack of October 7th. Do you assess, and do you and your colleagues assess, that the online environment is what is driving that? Or how do you guys look at that, both in the US and to the extent I imagine you work with counterparts in Europe and elsewhere? What is driving it even before the acute crisis of October 7th?
It is certainly facilitating it and making it much, much easier. So if we look at other movements, I mean, even if we looked at the trajectory of Al-Qaeda, and our colleague on the HSAC, Ali Soufan, has done phenomenal work on this. And you think about how bin Laden spread his messages in written fatwas and then DVDs, online, Anwar al-Awlaki on YouTube and things like that, moving then to social media with the so-called Islamic State. We've seen many groups use that trajectory. White supremacists, neo-Nazis, 30 years ago, they had to send away for materials to a P.O. box. Now they can go online and within a matter of seconds, and often facilitated by the algorithms that many of these platforms use, they can gain access to that material and worse, and also material from other violent extremist ideologies whose viewpoints they may not share except in their hatred for specific groups, whether it's the Jewish community, the Muslim community, Christian community, whatnot. So it has made the information more accessible. And so we have seen the ability for people to gain that information and then become radicalized and motivated to action, and the encouragement of that. So as one example, in a post-October 7th environment, one of the things that we have charted an incredibly disturbing increase in is the use of sexually violent language in the narratives online. So prior to October 7th, it would be unusual, not unheard of, but unusual to hear terminology related to sexual violence against Jewish women or against the Jewish community. Of course, we saw on October 7th, the use of sexual violence, rape as a tool, incredible acts of barbarity. And now we are seeing in the online environment calls for raping Jewish women, beheading Jewish children or members of the community. So we have seen that adoption of that language, which has spread much more quickly than we would have in a pre-October 7th environment or without the use of social media.
I want to ask you, Michael, sort of thinking about how the Jewish community reacts to this environment. So one of the things that I do think has happened here in the United States, even just in my conversations with friends and colleagues, is that post October 7th, even more members of the Jewish community are more aware of their personal security, more fearful about their children. I want to take you back to 2018 and the Tree of Life synagogue shooting in Pittsburgh, which killed 11 worshipers. And that individual, for our viewers, was convicted and sentenced to the death penalty in Pennsylvania earlier this year. His motivation was really hatred. And the White House and other organizations are focused on that issue of combating hate. But your organization, I think, is more focused on the security, on the preparedness and the preparation. And it's really focused on defense. Anyone who is involved in synagogue security knows that within the communities, there's always a little bit of pushback, right? When some new security measure is introduced, whether it's magnetometers, whether it's locking the front door and being on a buzzer, no matter where folks are around the country, whatever community it is, whichever synagogue, whichever institution it is, there's always some resistance to, well, we shouldn't have to have this. We shouldn't have to lock the doors. We shouldn't have to have magnetometers. We shouldn't have to take these extra measures. How do you react to that sentiment?
Well, I would suggest, and I do suggest to most people, that if they think about their own homes and whether they lock the doors, most people will say yes. And then I ask, do you consider your home unwelcoming or uninviting? And most people would say, of course not. And so, you know, it is a reality in today's world that we have to lock in most communities our home, or we should, but we don't consider the way that we are received or we receive people in our homes as uninviting or unwelcoming. And we have to really consider that very similarly in house of worship security. The reality is, I wish we lived in a society where we didn't have to have doors that have locks and or magnetometers or ballistic glass on our day schools, at our community centers, or to, you know, visit a government building. But as a society, we have, you know, usually over four dozen mass attacks in this country. So that reality requires us as a society writ large to be prepared. Add to that the fact that the Jewish community is under a higher level of threat, and then it becomes a question of how do we balance welcome and opening with being safe and secure. And to go back to, you know, the beginning of your question with Pittsburgh, we know from the trial that the offender in that case surveilled Jewish institutions and made a determination of a target based on that surveillance. So while I would like to live in a different world, we don't. And so we have to prepare for that reality. I would rather be prepared for the reality and be engaged with it and empower the community than live in a world where we deny that reality. And too often I have heard the phrase, and anyone who has served in law enforcement or national security has heard it after an incident, I never thought it could happen here. We have to get over that sense of denial. And Pittsburgh, if I may, is a phenomenal example of where the community did prepare diligently. 11 people were murdered. 6 individuals were casualties, to include 4 highly trained Pittsburgh police officers. That is a reality when you have someone armed with a semi-automatic weapon and thousands of rounds of ammunition who wants to attack a facility that is meant for prayer, worship, gathering, and peace. But also what happened was a lot of work to do assessments, to train the congregants, and to ensure that there were protocols in place so that the Rabbi Myers in that instance was carrying a cell phone and called 911 as soon as the attack happened, because that had been the training and the discussion he had with the security director that was working on behalf of the Jewish Federation there. With the exception of one individual, every person that had gone through active threat training in that building survived that day. Mm-hmm. And so there are lessons to be learned that in the face of tragedy, we don't have to simply lie down. We have to prepare for the moment. And that's what we're working to do from a safety and security perspective.
So one of the other significant incidents that thankfully turned out better in terms of safety and life-saving measures was just last year in 2022, when an assailant took the rabbi and 3 other people hostage at Congregation Beth Israel in Colleyville, Texas. And I've actually been to that temple. I lived for a couple years outside of Fort Worth, and there weren't a lot of places to worship around there, but I actually remember visiting a couple decades ago, that particular temple. In that attack, the motivation was different. It was an international, a foreign person who came there with ostensibly a political motive, the release of Afia Siddiqui, who was an Al-Qaeda affiliate and was in federal prison for attacking U.S. military members when she was being questioned in Afghanistan. But the rabbi in that incident has said publicly that the security training that he received was essential. So from your perspective, it's hard to think of these incidents in terms of a success story, but how do you assess the rabbi's calling out of the security training in particular and the outcome of that incident differently?
So I go back to two thoughts. You know, I'm here in the city of Chicago. On December 1st, today, in 1958, we had the worst school fire in the history of the United States at the Our Lady of the Angels school. A total of 92 kids and three nuns lost their lives. It remains the worst tragedy of school fire in the history of the United States. Shortly thereafter, a decision was made collectively by us as a society that we were not going to tolerate that. We weren't going to let it happen again. And roughly 68% of all communities implemented new fire safety and security protocols to include the modern fire drill that I am certain that anyone who is based in the United States on this webinar today knows by heart, regardless of where we are. Total of 16,500 public school buildings were brought up to new fire code in a very, very short order. We made a decision as a society that we were going to be able to address this. And as a result of that, since 1958, not a single kid has lost their life in a school fire in the United States. Now, we could train people on school fires and fires in general and scare them to death about what happens if you're in a building that has a fire. We don't do that. We work to empower the community with information. That's exactly what we're working to do in the security space. So Colleyville, Texas, and you having lived outside of Fort Worth, when we were approached, our goal is not to train individual institutions. It is to build a security shield over the entirety of the Jewish community of North America. So there are roughly six institutions in Tarrant County and Fort Worth. We worked with all six of them because we are not going to choose the time and place of the next incident. We can choose our preparation. And if you had asked me to stick a pin in the map of where the offender in that case might have shown up to any one of 12,500 Jewish facilities on that date in January of last year, the likelihood that I would have picked Congregation Beth Israel in Colleyville, Texas is minimal. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to take that comprehensive approach. It involved doing assessments. It involved doing training. It involved applying for federal grant funds, all of which was effectuated. And as we say, you don't rise to the occasion, you fall back to your level of training. In that instance, the training that Rabbi Charlie Citron Walker had, Jeff Cohen, one of the other hostages who was just here in our office last week visiting us, that helped them get through the situation in a coordinated, empowering way. And that saves lives. And that's what we're aiming to do. We've trained over 30,000 people in this community this year, and we're going to not give up until we train every single member of the community.
I want to come back to thinking about pre and post October 7th. You mentioned earlier that one of the ways the environment has changed is in a increased number of threats pertaining to sexual violence, because that was a substantial component of Hamas's attack on Israel on October 7th. I also want to cite for our audience some statistics that your organization put out following assessing what has happened after October 7th, which is that 772 incident reports that the Secure Community Network logged in October marks the highest of any month in Secure Community Network's 20-year history of tracking data. I have sort of two questions for this. Number one, we're now in the beginning of December. So have you started to see a bit of a decrease or are you still at a very heightened sort of post October 7th level? And then two, how does this affect other communities? There are also members of the Arab and Muslim community who are concerned and have had incidents of hate crimes and reporting increased. Are we at a place where every community needs a secure community network because they feel like government is not enough?
So on the first question, we have not seen a let up. Okay. The 772 incident reports from October 7th to then October 31st, highest that we've ever recorded in that time frame, 200% higher than the month previous. November will continue to shatter a month-to-month record from November 2023 compared to November 2022. The community is rightfully on edge. And they are being aware. They are, if you see something, say something. Even the statistics that you cite at the beginning from the director, that 60% of religiously motivated hate crimes impacting the Jewish community, we know that that is a vast undercount of likely hate crimes that are occurring around the country across the United States, which is why we're encouraging people to report, and why as a Jewish community, we have worked between organizations, us, AJC, ADL, and others, to coordinate on our intelligence and information sharing so we have an accurate understanding. And I think I can speak for all of us in stating that the numbers are not going down. And they are reflective of the fact that the hate is not going away. We monitored over 1,000 protests and events, vigils, counter-protests since October 7th, the majority of which are pro-Hamas, anti-Israel, anti-Jewish, where there is blatant and open anti-Semitism. That's happening on the streets of America in 2023. And to go to your second question, that reality is not just a reality for the Jewish community. This country was founded on the principle, one of them, of religious freedom and liberty. If we have a situation where any faith-based community cannot walk down the street and show their faith, whether it's a Jewish man wearing a kippah or a Muslim woman wearing a hijab because they are frightened of being victimized or harassed or their business is vandalized because of who they are, not even where they come from, that sacrifices what religious freedom and liberty looks like. So I do believe that the work that we are doing is critical for all faith-based communities. We have a collective organizing capability in the Jewish community. We work to make all of our resources available to all faith-based communities. And unfortunately, I think it's going to become an increasing necessity that other faith-based communities have this type of infrastructure, not because government isn't doing enough. I think that our federal partners, particularly at the FBI and Homeland Security and state and local law enforcement, have been phenomenal across this country, but they have a multitude of demands. Mm-hmm. And they have certain resource requirements, and that requires all of us to step up and step in together to work together to fight this hate.
Michael Masters, we are at time. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today. Appreciate the work that you and all of your colleagues at Secure Community Network, with all of your state and local and federal partners, do to keep the Jewish community safe. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of CNES Live, a production of the Center for a New American Security. This episode was produced by Anna Peterson and Charles Horn, with design help from Melody Cook and Ren Rothback. Please rate and subscribe from wherever you get your podcasts.